Erlen Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to 92.6 FM. This is Verulam Sport Sportcast, where each and every single week, the team behind the award-winning Verulam Sports will debate, dissect, and analyse a sporting topic of your choosing. I say that, but every now and again, we like to mix things up just a touch. And since this has been a bit of a landmark week for Verulam Sports, we clock up 75 podcast episodes. Since we focused on that in the lockdown period, we thought we would take that landmark and give you a feast of sporting analysis of the last 75 years of standout moments in sport. So many possibilities, not enough to squeeze into a Verulam Sport Sportcast 6 through 7, but plenty to get our teeth stuck into. But naturally, 75 years of epic sporting moments, events, dynamic action, so many memories. Where were you when's? I know you've got opinions on this one, so keep them coming. Tweet us at Verulam Sport, your favourite moments, your favourite memories across 75 years of sporting action. So many Olympics, so many World Cups, just so many memories. And I want to hear yours. Tweet at Verulam Sport. Really looking forward to this one. And Jason, as always, whilst we kind of took a slightly dictatorial stance this week and kind of chose the sporting topic, we always put it out there for social media engagement. And I know, as always, our listeners have been super diligent, super busy across social media, keeping you nice and active. The Machine, Jason McKenna, what's the social media world been telling us about their favourite sporting memories across three quarters of a century?
My goodness, Tony. I mean, three quarters of a century puts us back to 1945. So there is plenty of memories here. I picked out quite a few, but if yours was left out, we're sorry. But you can still get involved over social media, email, and however you want to contact us at Verulam Sport. But one of the big ones was Roger Bannister breaking that 1 minute mile. And I think we've kind of mentioned that with Elliot Kipchoge. Usain Bolt.
Ooh, at the Olympics. That would be a bit special. A 1 minute mile, the 4 minute mile, right?
The 4 minute mile, yes, indeed. 1 minute mile would be absolutely ridiculous. Now, Usain Bolt was also mentioned with his treble, although that was subsequently, I do have to actually point out to the listener there, it was a double treble and then a double because unfortunately there was some misdemeanors with teammates. Mm-hmm. Then Diego Maradona, 1986, set the world alight. Senna in F1. We've got plenty of cricketing moments, especially the Ashes very recently. And obviously England winning the Cricket World Cup. And we spoke to Chris Folkes very recently about that as well. So there's plenty in there. Rugby, the World Cup 2003, but also the first ever World Cup, the first ever Lions tour. I mean, the list could go on here, Tony. Golf, swimming, and the Olympics as well. And I think that's something that we'll get onto a little bit later in terms of that. But I'm sorry, but there is so many wonderful moments in these 75 years. And I think I found that hard myself to actually pick out a couple in that vast array of amazing sporting moments.
Do you know what I love? I love the fact that the Roger Bannister moment was mentioned there, that 4 minute mile. Obviously, it's been surpassed since, but it did kind of really shine a beacon to what the human is possible of that landmark figure of 4 minutes. was kind of deemed almost impossible for a human to achieve. And certain humans, when they hear this is impossible, they go, well, no, actually, I'm going to find a way to do that. And goodness gracious me, he did. That was way back in 1954. And I love that because, like you say, Jason, there are simply so many divine memories of sporting theatre, drama and world-class moments that you could literally devote a lifetime to recalling. But I love that the Roger Bannister one is in there. And I'll tell you for why, because so many amazing memories, and I'm delighted to hear that the ODI victory in England, which was so dramatic, was mentioned. And again, it was wonderful to chat to Chris Wokes. Do check out that podcast. World Cup winner, of course, as he is. But that's so recent in our memory, isn't it? And I think we've got this quality, this tendency as humans to sort of focus in on the most immediate moment, and then that's the most glorious thing of all time. So I'm delighted, I've got to tell you, that Roger Bannister was in there. But there's going to be so many amazing ones to pick out. I'm really looking forward to this one. But just quickly, just a quick aside, one of the most important sporting memories in that time span, and indeed, according to many, when football began, was, of course, the inception of the Premier League over 25 years ago, 27th year, I believe, that it's in now. And the Premier League kicked off last weekend, and with it saw the return of the Verum Sports Presenters Premier League Prediction League. And I know, I just know, you sitting at home, you're a punditry guru, you get them right each and every single week. Well, come on, put yourself to the test and challenge yourself each and every single week. It's very simple. You get 3 points for predicting accurately the scoreline in any Premier League game fixture. 1 point if you get the correct result, but you might be out by a goal or two here or there. And nil-point, nothing in this game for an inaccurate results prediction. After just 1 week, it's tight. And obviously, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and a whole myriad of other sporting cliches. But week one results have been in. They're adjudicated and they're official. And bringing up the rear at the moment is our newest acquisition, Neil Stock. The machine, Jason McKenna, is on 4 points. Neil in last at present at 3 points. Voice of the Saints, Graham Griffin. Check him out on Saturdays. And I'm actually commentating with him for the Saints this weekend. And Graham Griffin is the voice of the Saints. And also check him out on Tuesdays for the local football show. Great stuff. He had a good effort first week in. 5 points. I started reasonably strongly. Defending champion. I'm usually not very good, but defending champ. I picked up 6 points. But leading the way is the always charismatic, the man, the legend, Matthew Turvey, with 9 points and two correct scoreline predictions amongst those 9 points. So awesome work there. That's going to run throughout the season. And just a reminder to get involved with us each and every single Premier League weekend. 3 points for a correct scoreline, 1 point for a correct result, nil point for getting it wrong. So yeah, the Premier League kicked off. It was a big, important part of the sporting culture, certainly here in England, and I would argue certainly across the world. But that's now by the by. Now, here and now, tonight, Jason, what have you got for us from your own choice of a world of possibilities spanning 75 years of sporting memories?
Yeah, well, I've come up with a few kind of maybe different ones because, you know, with these sporting memories, I think we've covered quite a few of these amazing ones, you know, Roger Bannister, Muhammad Ali. These are all people that we talked about in recent weeks. And I think it kind of goes without saying that these are amazing, amazing moments. So the two that I kind of wanted to bring up, one is quite a personal memory of London 2012. But the one that I actually want to start with is the fact that the World Cup, in terms of football, but also in rugby, has been shared out a little bit more amongst the nations of the world. And I think that's fantastic. I want to talk about from the fact from 94 onwards, we've seen it on different continents. We've seen it in 94 in America. We saw it in France, so Europe in 1998. 2002 was Japan. But the big one, I think one of the most important ones, was the fact that it was in Africa in 2010, the Vuvuzela World Cup, and one of the best ones around. But it's kind of a multi-faceted discussion here. But I think the fact that the face of the World Cup has changed from being a European or South American dominated tournament to one that anybody and everybody around the world can buy into, I think is fantastic. And I suppose it does open out a little bit to the fact that the Rugby World Cup, the most recent one, was in Japan as well. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, it is a little bit of a sales technique with the FIFA or, you know, the rugby union kind of hierarchies to sell it to these new nations. But I think there's also a real genuine human growth story here. The fact that people around the world, you know, people in Japan or America have often not been able to see teams play in their backyard. You know, the best players around the world, unless they're either coming to the end of their careers or if it's for like an exhibition match, which doesn't matter. And then we mm-hmm. see 94 World Cup in America. You've got the best on at their front door. Brazil mm-hmm. and Italy put on one of the age-old classic World Cup finals. 2002 Japan Korea World Cup. You know, one of the first tournaments across two nations for the World Cup. It's absolutely fantastic that that was brought to Asia, and then Africa was given a huge boost with the South African World Cup. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that it's made the appeal that anybody and everybody can truly be involved with football was a really heartwarming story for me. Now, obviously, the caveat to that is the next upcoming World Cup is probably mired in one of the biggest controversies mm-hmm. in sport. The fact that it is, you know, going potentially to a new area that hasn't been before in Qatar, the Middle East, I would say is a positive, but the methodology that it got there mm-hmm. is a very negative story for football. So it's a multifaceted thing here. Now, I'd be really interested to know your feelings on it, Tony. Is this a real genuine positive for the sport, or the fact that it's kind of just a sales pitch and really the fact that it's going to Asia or America or Africa is by the by and it should go to the best hosting nation instead of a sales tactic?
I think it's a beautiful point and a really nice take on this topic, Jason. But I'm kind of in two minds. First and foremost, the football is the beautiful game and it is the world sport, principally because I guess there's running and obviously boxing where you don't need much. Cricket kind of has that Asian appeal, subcontinent, where you again don't need too much to kind of take it up and play. But football transcends all sports. It always has done and it always will do. And therefore, I think it is important that the global game is given a global platform. And I think it's important that it is mixed up and shared around. I'm not going to talk at all about Qatar because Mama always told me, if you ain't got nothing good to say, say nothing at all. It's a very deep political minefield. And I must confess, I'm not fully au fait with all the comings and goings over there. I have my general opinions and I will let my silence speak volumes. However, setting that aside, I think generally, Jason, I think it is brilliant, the spread of it. But what I think would be better is that then it is properly followed up with, and not just a commitment to these flashes, these explosive moments of global appeal, but a consistent spread of the economics. And we've had long conversations. Check out our podcasting recently on the economics of sport. We kind of covered this to a strong degree. I think that level of commitment is infinitely more important than sort of these just moments, so to speak, which then may take another generation before they spin back around. Again, you just think sometimes we're going to talk Olympics. Of course we are. And so many great Olympic memories across 75 years. Goodness me. But for instance, you know, sometimes you look at things like in the Greek Olympics or even a Barcelona, and some of the stadium were in disarray, and they spent so much money investing into getting a stadium up to what X quality required in order to gain these prestige moments, that it almost it was unsustainable. And there needs to be across all sports a very conscious effort to make programs that sustain rather than flash in a pan. So generally, Jason, I think it is imperative and I'd use that word, imperative, that the Football World Cup, a la the Olympics, is spread across planet Earth. But I just hope that lessons are learnt and that it is then used not just as the icing on the cake, but to be then sort of, you know, filtered down, get it back to grassroots, and therefore over time encourage nations to become more competitive at the elite level. That's my ultimate hopes. But I tell you what, I must say, just great memories spring to mind. You were brilliant in addressing that final, of course, 94, where the divine ponytail Baggio sadly missed one and was visibly distraught. But, you know, America did put on a hell of a show, didn't they? I know they were Diana Ross slightly weirdly missed a, you know, an open goal in the opening ceremony, but they are past masters, USA, on putting on a global spectacle. And they really, really did that. And of course, for me, and I'm sure it resonates with your good self, Jason, I'll never forget Ray Houghton's effort against the beaten finalists in Italy for the Republic of Ireland. And I tell you what, More people need to get involved with the old school pony roly poly celebration. Ray Houghton, great effort in that tournament, and it was a great tournament. Jack Charlton's men was, you know, his character, his charisma came to the fore. Obviously, controversy came to the fore with Maradona, but Brazil were brilliant, and it was a wonderful tournament. So yeah, great, just lovely memories there. I tell you what, always remember your show every bit as much as it is ours. So many memories across 75 years of sport. I want to hear that from your favourites, but you've got to have World Cup memories in that time span. Get involved with us. Tweet us at Verum Sport. So yeah, Jason, obviously it's a wonderful topic, but underneath that now, obviously England weren't there in 94, but across this 75-year span, and certainly peaking, as you say, from that 94 moment onwards, what are your instant memories when you hear the phrase Football World Cup?
Yeah, well, I mean, kind of continuing on with the trend of 94 onwards, obviously I was born in 94, so that's why I've kind of framed it in that time period. So the 98 World Cup is the one with my first memories, and I do have French family, so I have a French top from that fantastic home win for that home nation. But I would say, actually, when I think of World Cup, when I think of amazing moments, I had the absolute pleasure and luck of being in Italy when they won the World Cup in 2006. It was an unforgettable moment. So we were just there. We hadn't even planned it. We were just on holiday in Bellagio in the north of Italy. And the World Cup final was on. We thought, you know what, we'll go down and we'll watch it in the town centre. Now, obviously in England, that kind of thing is a much more rowdy affair, which, you know, I'm not passing judgment. But in Italy, it was more kind of like going to an upmarket restaurant with your whole town. Everybody was super dignified, drinking bottles of wine. It was a surreal experience. And then, you know, when the football started, it got a little bit more rowdy. But my goodness, you know, even when they scored, when they celebrated, the Italians did it with style, with class, with pizzazz and dignity. And yeah, it's one of the best memories that I have of football, being in a nation that's won a World Cup. And it was also humbling as well, because I was there with my grandparents at the time. And even in the furore of the moment, the Italians were still courteous and kind enough to help my grandparents up, who were struggling, you know, on sticks and stuff to move around the city, to help them move about. You know, they'll go, hey, going absolutely crazy, and still remembering that, you know, the elderly people were helped and looked after. And I tell you what as well, the day after, there wasn't a smashed window, a broken bottle or any kind of litter. So that's one of the standout memories. And then the second one is the 2010 World Cup, from the fact that tiki-taka football, you know, that possession-based football, which I always hark on about, Cruyffian, Spain brought that to the fore. They brought it to the door. And Holland, who, you know, were the nation that pioneered that style of football, actually played anti-football that day. But good football won out. And I would say that's probably one of the best footballing nations ever You know, you mentioned Brazil there, 1994, and in previous kind of incarnations of that Brazil team, they've done fantastic. But for me, mm-hmm. kind of looking at historical footage as well, the Spain 2010 team, I think, are the best of all time. And we've seen Germany in 2014, we've seen France in 2018, but you know, although those World Cup finals were probably a bit more exciting, especially the most recent one with mm-hmm. six goals, I think the way that Spain went about winning was the best ever. So I don't know your opinions on that, Tony. What do you think when we mention World Cup? What is the synonymous memory with you? And maybe, like me, your favourite ever World Cup team or final?
Well, I'm going to drill into 1966 and all that in just a little moment. And I'm sure everybody listening knows what we're about to build up to. But in terms of World Cups, I love that your anecdote there with regards to Italy winning it. And I'm lucky, I've got quite a few second-generation Italian friends, and they actually went out to Berlin for the final. They weren't able to get into the stadium, but I'll tell you what, I saw some photos, and they had a mega time. And to this day, they just still go on about it, and quite rightly so. There is something to be said for a World Cup win. I love your shouts on the Spanish team, and I know you have a massive appreciation and deep understanding for that tiki-taka football. For me, so hard, almost impossible to compare eras. There are those who will say the 1970s Brazil team with Socrates and Pelé was amongst the best. And, you know, the almost perfect team goal where I think it was Pelé who laid the final pass on, I believe, for Socrates to blast home is quite simply sublime. And the thing is, well, I referenced that. Again, it was before my time. And whilst you can watch things on tape, you know yourself, Jason, there is something for that live experience, which is only when then you truly appreciate the level of quality and human excellency on display. As a consequence, I don't want to sit on the fence. I do find it nigh on impossible to compare era. But, you know, again, in that 94 to now time span, I just thought, again, with class as always controversy, I think back, of course, to Ronaldo and his dubious efforts at the referenced French World Cup, where France won. Was he injured? Was he psychologically struggling? Didn't look the same Ronaldo in that final. Not to diminish by any means France's efforts, who were outstanding on the day. But again, just looking at all-time football World Cups, you look at, in particular to this time frame, actually, closer doesn't get enough credit for me, the great German, who totally is great. All-time yeah. top goal scorer in World Cup history with 16. The great Ronaldo, the original Ronaldo we've mentioned, has 15. Then another German in with 14, Gerd Müller. France's Jules Fontaine has 13. And then it's Pelé, of course, the legendary Pelé with 12. Closer tops the shop, doesn't get enough credit, is my final point on recent World Cup history.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think Miroslav Klose is one of the criminally underlooked international and probably just general strikers in history, not just World Cup history. I think his role as that kind of in the box, he didn't do a lot of fancy stuff, but he didn't need to. 16 World Cup goals, that is absolutely remarkable. And I'm so glad as well that he finished his career with a World mm-hmm. Cup medal, because it would have probably been unfair that the top goal scorer in World Cup history doesn't go with it. But Tony, I think you've teased it. What are we going to be talking about next in this 75 special?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to build up to it again. But so many amazing memories. It's simply impossible to cover it in 6-7. There's going to be more of this in our podcast. But quite simply, we could devote the rest of our lives to dissecting the last 75 years of sporting memories. No doubt there's going to be some amazing ones created in the near future too. I want to reference briefly, though, Andy Murray's victory over Djokovic, July 2013, to win Wimbledon. The first Brit to triumph at SW14 since Fred Perry, 7 years before, back in 1936. We talk sometimes the sporting cliche of monkey on the back. Well, that was a ginormous King Kong of a gorilla on the British sporting psyche. Credit to the efforts of Tim Henman eking the best out of his talents to make several semi-finals. But Andy Murray took it to the next level. With the weight of the nation on his shoulders, he rose to the occasion, and that was one for the memory banks. I also want to give a big shout out going into the Olympian world for a great American. There's so many Americans and so many great Olympic memories. But Jackie Joyner Kersee, 1988 in Seoul, set a record to claim gold in the heptathlon, 7,291 points she bagged. Then just 5 days later, she claimed another world record at the long jump. What an effort, what a games for one of the greatest all-around all-time athletes, Jackie Joyner Kersee. You and I could speak forever and a day about Muhammad Ali. They're on lots of podcasts. Do check them out. But of course, when he became the youngest heavyweight champion of the world at the time, beating the unbeatable Liston and then bouncing back 12 years later in Zaire to become the first man at the time to reclaim the heavyweight title of the world, beating another invincible foe in George Foreman. Muhammad Ali, again, he could devote a show to him in 75 years of memories. I also want to give a big shout out to Tiger Woods. The fall from grace and the return to glory is a great story. But his first title in 97, I don't want to get too political, but we know at the moment that there is so much political strife and rigmarole on Black Lives Matter and all of that. Again, not going to go into it too much. But 97, Tiger Woods opened up the world of golf to the Black and African communities. Great effort, and it's a great stellar career. He's on 15 slams, chasing down Jack Nicklaus, who has 18. Nicklaus, the greatest statistically, the winningest in golf, claimed his last major, age 46, in 1986. So many, many memories, so many other ones that we could delve into. Always want your views. 75 years of sporting moments, sporting history and sporting memories. What are your faves? Tweet us at Verulam Sport. But, you know, it wouldn't be right or appropriate or indeed proper if somebody in a 75-year memory show didn't bring up 1966. July the 30th, 1966, to be precise, and England claim the Jules Rimet Trophy at the time, which translates to the World Cup. It remains to date England's only World Cup win and, of course, actually, their only major trophy at the international football level. Again, as to whether that should be the case, why haven't we embraced more? That's a long debate. We've touched upon it several times. Your views always welcome. Tweet us at Verulam Sports. Of course, this was an epic, one of the games for the memory banks, one of the all-time classics. At Wembley, in front of royalty, it was fit for the Queen. England defeat West Germany 4-2, but needed extra time to do that. Hat-trick hero Jeff Hurst, and of course that iconic piece of Kenneth Wilson home commentary. The crowd are running onto the pitch. They think it's all over. Well, it is now, and it was then. Wonderful work. It was a controversial England team in the sense that they were dubbed the wingless wonders. Everybody thought you needed wingers to win football tournaments at those days. Goes to remind us all that it isn't about the system, it's about the players, and it's about playing football that suits those players. Jason, so many amazing facts around. Before I could delve into them, I just also want to say, and I've said this in the past, massive respect to Jimmy Greaves, who was the England superstar coming into this tournament. He was all but kicked out of the action, meaning he didn't actually play in the final. And ultimately, in those days, substitutes didn't get a World Cup winning medal. So despite being one of England's all-time top goal scorers, one of the stars leading up to the tournament, he was kicked out of that game, the final, didn't play, and was only almost not quite posthumously, that would be when he's dead, but many years after the event, awarded, quite rightly, a World Cup winning medal. So I do want to give him respect. But into the breach stepped Jeff Hurst, and a hat-trick for him, and we'll talk all about it. But I mentioned a few facts. Check this out. 96,924 people packed out Wembley, and 32.3. I'm going to repeat that because it's astonishing. 32.3 million people in the UK watched that final. It remains the UK's most watched TV event all time. So forget the moon landing. England reaching for the stars and claiming the World Cup is and remains to date the most watched TV event in UK TV history. 32.3 million TV viewers. Quite simply astonishing. England were in Group 1 and they were fared against Uruguay, Mexico and also France. Goalless in their first game against Uruguay. They prevailed 2-0 against Mexico, matching that scoreline 2-0 also against France. West Germany were in Group 2. They smashed Switzerland 5-0. It was goalless for them against Argentina. They then beat Spain 2-1. In the quarterfinals, it was a tempestuous affair, England against Argentina, and it was a narrow, scrappy victory, which England prevailed 1-0 to move through to a semi-final against Portugal. West Germany looked incredibly impressive indeed in their quarterfinal win, putting 4 goals past Uruguay. Into the semis, England overcame Portugal by 2-1. West Germany matched that scoreline, beating the Soviet Union, their great rivals for more than sporting reasons, by 2-1. England were managed by the great Sir Alf Ramsey and captained by the legendary and iconic Bobby Moore. This was a final for the ages. Germany actually took the lead after 12 minutes, following a mix-up at the back, which enabled Helmut Heller to score. Hurst, though, got his first of the match as England equalised after 18 minutes. England nudged ahead after 77, with Martin Peters, the only other man for England other than Hurst to get on the goal sheet that day, converting an Alan Ball free kick. It was diverted into his path from a deflected Hurst effort. West Germany were immensely resilient, though, and they were always going to fight. They kept pressing, and a nervy England on 89 minutes conceded a free kick. There was a bit of a ricocheting around, but the ball found its way eventually to Wolfgang Weber, who snatched an equaliser. 2-2 after extra time. After 90 regular minutes, meaning extra time. Now, this extra time, I know, obviously, you know, we are English. There is an element of bias, but this is in all-time sporting folklore. Before the Hurst heroics, Bobby Charlton actually struck the post after 5 minutes of extra time and had another effort fade agonizingly wide. Just a quick note on Charlton. Of course, all the headlines are about Hurst and his hat trick. And of course, we've mentioned the star that was Greaves not making the final. But Bobby Charlton was one of the stars of world football at this time. You've referenced it. It's been mentioned in another podcast when we analysed England's all-time 11 teams, which Bobby Charlton naturally was a walk-in. This final saw him just cast aside any ego, and he played a much deeper, much more defensive-minded role. And that ultimately, whilst he didn't get the limelight, was so instrumental in this marvellous and historic victory. Anyway, moving on. I think it's fair to say that Hurst's next effort is one of the most controversial goals in not just World Cup, but footballing history. Of course, 1966, no goal line technology, no VAR in place. A bit of a ricocheting around saw the ball fall to Hurst's feet and it sort of hit the woodwork and was deemed to be a goal. In recent years, even with modern-day technology, there's a little bit of two schools of thought here. But the most recent that I can see is, again, it depends how literal one wants to take the letter of the law. Of course, quite frankly, this is just kind of academic because the result, the goal was given by Swiss referee Gottfried Diemst on the pitch, and it's in the history books. England have that title. But if you literally want to interpret the letter of the law, which says for a goal to stand, all of the ball, by which, of course, it stands to reason, 100% of the ball has to cross the line, then, and this isn't going to be necessarily an appealing one to many, I know there's still multiple strands of thought to this, but most modern technology seems to suggest that 97% of the ball crossed the line, literally meaning that by the truest interpretation of the rules of the game, then that goal shouldn't have stood. Nevertheless, like I say, it's in the history books. It's all irrelevant now. And, you know, credit to Hurst. But my goodness me, that was not the end of this epic tale. West Germany showing borderline heroism. You know, they just constantly kept fighting, seeking another equaliser. But they coughed up possession, seeing skipper Bobby Moore, appropriately enough, pick out an unmarked Jeff Hurst, who fired home. As the pass was splayed, many fans streamed onto the pitch. Cue that epic line again. I think in the near future, we may well be analysing all-time great commentators. And this is maybe one of the most all-time great lines in all sporting commentary history. Kenneth Wolstenholm took the moment. And again, there are some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now. Wonderful work and a World Cup win. It remains England's only World Cup triumph. Indeed, their only victory at the highest level in elite international football. So much could be said about this. I hope I've put it into some context. If you could remember that game or if you were at that match, I'd dearly love to hear from you. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Nevertheless, I'm sure you've seen all the images. I know you've got opinions. Should England have won more? We believe so, but I want to hear your views. Tweet at Verulam Sport and keep those 75 years of memories flowing. Incidentally, this has crossed culture. It featured in season 5 of Mad Men. So it was a little bit insane there, England fans running onto the pitch, and why not? That was epic. It was memorable. And it certainly has to feature in our 75 years of sporting memories. Jason, obviously, well before our time. But again, we've all seen the pictures. What are your thoughts on what remains England's only triumph at the highest level in football?
Yeah, I think the story with the 1966 World Cup is an interesting one because in terms of English folklore, it is something celebrated, really seen as something positive. But if you kind of visit the narratives around the rest of the world, especially South America, there's a lot of downward play on the actual England victory there. Now, you know, we talk about obviously the English victory, Bobby Charlton, Jeff Hurst, but obviously Jimmy Greaves, fantastic, you know, at the peak footballers at the time. But then you had Eusebio, Pelé, Garrincha, you know, people like that were at this World Cup. And the interesting kind of thing about the way that England progressed to the final, possibly the inclusion of certain nations, those excluded, the fact that, you know, Portugal still to this day attests that before the semi-final of the World Cup, there was a group of individuals that were sent possibly by England or just, you know, England fans that chose by themselves to have a little kind of party outside the hotel room. It is a fascinating story. And I think it even adds to this victory. And I think possibly after the World Cup in England, maybe it's kind of testament to if there is some truth to these hard feelings. The fact that there hasn't been a World Cup in England and that there hasn't been a victory and quite often decisions have gone against England from the footballing community makes you do question whether hard feelings have been felt for far too long in the community. You know, you just have to look at what happened with the 1970 World Cup. The narrative, the myth, the legend around 1966 lives on and possibly, you know, inhibits England a little bit still to this day. You know, every time we go into a World Cup, the Three Lions song, all the comparisons are there. The fact that it has been done before, it can be done again. And then when it doesn't, these questions kind of come in. You know, the question of the morality of the players, the want, all these things kind of come in. And is it fair? I don't know, but would you say that the shadow of the 1966 World Cup has possibly plagued England since then? Maybe 1970, not so much, you know, given the benefit of doubt. But every tournament since then has been seen as a failure for England not to lift it? Is it because of that World Cup win, or is it because of the failures of the English footballing system?
I'm being much documented on this. I'm sorry, I just don't buy that. I truly don't. Look, great sporting teams build on great sporting cultures. And they take this not as a kind of claustrophobic sense of fear, anxiety, but something of great pride to be built on. You know, you mentioned that's the great Spanish team, and obviously, you know, I slightly sat on the fence, not really willing to debate era by era. But look, what they achieved in quote unquote their golden era was back-to-back Euros plus sandwich with a World Cup win. Unprecedented in sporting history. And they had so many years before that of pressure. You know, I mentioned earlier in the piece, Andy Murray claimed the Wimbledon victory. 77 years of pressure on that man's great, that great Scot's shoulders, overcame it, and then claimed another Wimbledon, as well as a US Open. New Zealand, they were talking Rugby World Cup. I'm going to come to that in a bit. But there was controversy for New Zealand, actually, when they lost out to South Africa. Another moment I'll reference in more detail momentarily. But, you know, again, after those many years of hurt for them, since they claimed the first title back in the first Rugby World Cup, 87, it took them 20 years to get back to the top, 24 really, winning again in 2011. And this is a nation where rugby is God. And then they won back to back. So my point's very simple, actually, Jason. Great sporting teams, great sporting countries, great sporting cultures, they don't feel this as like a ball and chain, but rather almost like a baton that's to be passed on to the next generation. And we've, for whatever reason, it's wide and it's varied, and there's loads of debates to be had on this. We've kind of touched upon it in small degrees. It was fascinating, incidentally, to hear from One Day International World Cup winner Chris Wokes, his take on this. So I will flag that and signpost you all to check out Chris Wokes's podcast. Find it, of course, on the award-winning Radio Verulam website. Check out podcast. You can find that Chris Wokes chat. He's got fascinating and, of course, from the perspective of a World Cup winner, slightly more kind of learned in this context than you and indeed I. So yeah, Jason, I feel your point. I understand it. And obviously, I think one could say lots about the British kind of media's unique style of reporting and that weird appetite that they seem to enjoy. And I know we're a little cog in the chain of building up, hyping, and then slamming it down. It's perverse to me. But I don't accept all of that, because greats simply deal with it, and quite frankly they love it. And for whatever reason, and again it's wide and it's varied, it's never just as simple as this or that, England have had an unacceptable level of ignominious failures. Obviously moments of so near and we're getting excited, but just come on. It's unacceptable for me. If we consider this 75 years of sporting history, if we consider it now 50 plus years since that World Cup moment, in that time span, and I mean no disrespect, we've had Portugal win a Euros, Greece won a Euros, Denmark won a Euros that they didn't even originally qualify for. England have precisely in football, with all the infrastructure, with all the passion, with all the fan base, won precisely zilch post 66. I honestly think it is an abject failure, and I know Southgate and I know the DNA and the projects have been embracing things and working forwards, and I know that in the near future this could well be put to pass and another giant King Kong off the back. But until that happens, Jason, for me, I dub it unacceptable, and I don't buy the narrative that the ghost of 66 is the cause of all this inadequacy since. That's just my take. I want yours. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. But yeah, Jason, quickly, do you think maybe am I not being fair? Was that home victory and the weight of all that, and obviously the controversies that are bound up into that narrative, actually a massive factor in why we are yet to reclaim World Cup glory in a football context?
Yeah, I think, Tony, you know, I totally agree with you there. You know, I was kind of playing more devil's advocate, kind of enticing it out because it is thrown out in the media. And I totally disagree with it in terms of an excuse for the way that England have played over the past few decades since that World Cup win. I think, you know, we will probably do a whole podcast on this because it is a truly fascinating topic. But I think the reasons are nuanced. I think there's a lot of problems with the FA and kind of their attitudes, but also the huge thing which you pointed out is the perverse nature of a lot of the media. You know, the kind of, they want us to win, but at the same time they revel in the fact when it doesn't, because then they've got great, you know, newspaper headlines and whatnot. And I thought in the last World Cup, because of a lack of expectation, because that England squad wasn't very good, those kind of stories didn't circulate too much, and that did ease the pressure of the players. But what I would say...
But you know what, Jason? But you know what? Sorry to cut you short. And we've had this conversation, right? Again, I totally get that. And it would have been overachieving. But we've had this conversation before. And once again, when the opportunity comes, the greats seize that.
Yep.
And again, let's not forget, England has scored first against Croatia in the last World Cup semi-final. And then reverted to type, went into the shell, went insular. And it's almost as though then you feel this behemoth of the past weighing down on them. And that's just wrong. Don't get me wrong. I recognise that it's dead easy for me here in a nice little home studio. dead easy for us at the home and to point and to, you know, say this and that. I just get that. But my point's dead simple. Again, come off the hour, come off the man. And at the moment, we still haven't instilled that attitude, that culture. And until we do, until I see that visually, it remains to be seen for me. And it's a massive question mark hanging over England. And again, I don't know if that's adding to things, making things worse. But like I say, until it's almost a catch 22, isn't it? Until they do, it remains undone. And as I say, it's for me one of the most offensive, shocking and wrong, abjectly wrong, that given all the resource, all the passion that England have when it comes to football, to only have one World Cup. And again, you know, we're talking 75 years of memories here, and I know things are different and changed, but in World Cup bragging right terms, Uruguay with three have infinitely more than England's one, right? So yeah, Jason, again, that's I think we need to draw a line now under England football. It was awesome earlier. Your first choice was the Football World Cup in its panoply and its ability to spread the world. Now we're talking the kind of zenith of sporting global events, the Olympics, in particular, to our memories of London 2012. Hit me up. What springs to mind? What you got for us?
Well, I think it's when, you know, the song goes, football's coming home, but this is when sport came home. It was beautiful to see the London 2012 games. And the reason why I bring it up, again, kind of linked to my Italy, you know, story about the World Cup there. This Olympics, the fact that it was at home in London, I think it touched so many people's lives. It was a wonderful time. And I think in many ways, the whole of England, or especially London, kind of went into this little Olympic bubble, and the worries of the world kind of disappeared. And the build up to the Olympics, again, kind of, you know, obviously we've moved on from the World Cup kind of discussion with England and its failures. But the whole narrative leading up to the 2012 World Cup was London's not going to manage it. It's going to be a shambles. England's going to embarrass itself on the World Cup stage. And then I remember watching the opening ceremony. I had tickets in hand for some of the events as well, which I'll get onto in a moment or so. But I remember watching and, you know, I had the hairs up on my back and neck because I realised, you know what, this is actually going to be good. This is not just going to be good. This is going to be amazing. Danny Boyle with his opening ceremony. Mm-hmm. My goodness, it was such a wonderful mix. And I think it covered all the right areas that you want in British history. It highlighted some of the great, you know, highs and lows. But it was a truly British story there. Now, you know, I'm not a huge nationalist. I don't really care for that kind of rhetoric. But at that moment there, yeah, I was proud to be a Londoner. I felt, you know, super happy that this was in my area. But then there was the obvious kind of selfish thing that I can actually see the mm-hmm. best athletes in the world in my back garden. And for, you know, the whole time that was here, and I want to include the Paralympics as well, because absolutely. I think what the London kind of Olympics, because I include Paralympians under that Olympic kind of sphere. They are amazing athletes themselves. And during that whole time, what we achieved for kind of bringing Paralympics to the fore, because I don't think it had been celebrated like this before. People were actually going crazy to go to these events. So it was kind of a humbling and brilliant experience to change the mindset, not only of athletics fans, but just fans in general, mm-hmm. to encompassing in the Olympic bubble of Paralympics. Now, kind of there was a slow build-up here in Britain. You know, the first few kind of days, and there wasn't too much British gold medals. And then we kind of build it up to what was fantastic, you know, the first medal, the second, and then we had Super Sunday. And I remember, again, kind of linking it to my own experiences. I remember being on the tube kind of going to work one day. And so at the time, you know, I just kind of left college and that, and it was fantastic. And I remember they made an announcement on the tube that Britain had won another gold medal. And everybody in the tube carriage was like cheering and people discussing it. You know, the usual kind of mental image of the tube is everybody heads down, miserable. But during that time, people were actually discussing with each other who was winning gold, who was doing what. Oh my God, this is amazing. And when it came to the end of it, Britain had a lot to be proud of. You know, 29 gold medals, 65 medals in total, behind the behemoths of China and the United States. But what amazed me as well was the United States and Great Britain tied for world record beaten at that Olympics. You know, the host Great Britain came third, but I think it was one of the highest, you know, of all time. Obviously, China has done better in America, but it's one of, for us, quite a small nation to achieve so many medals was absolutely fantastic. We got Mo Farah, we got Jessica Ennis. Those are like the homegrown heroes. And then we had people like Usain Bolt changing the way. Andy Murray winning gold for tennis. There were so many highlights there, and I'm sure, Tony, you know, I've gone on a little bit here, but what were your, like, favourite memories of that? Because I'm sure every single person can kind of look back to 2012 and think, that was my favourite sport, favourite moment, and it throughout that whole time period, you had the moments of where were you when whatever happened.
Absolutely. Super Sunday resonates, doesn't it? And again, in the broadcasting world, for the sportscasters of the world, of which you and I are in our own little way, are prone to hyperbole. I know that's a shock to some, but Super Sunday was deeply appropriate, so powerful. And on that night, one of the most underrated sports stars in British context, we've had that conversation in the past, actually so underrated, he didn't even make our underrated conversation. I'm talking about Greg Rutherford. I'm really working determinedly, myself and the Verum Sport production elves, to see if we can get a chat with Greg Rutherford. I don't want to make any promises. We are working diligently. Of course, we have spoken to Sally Gunn, and we've spoken to Daley Thompson. They are two of the all-time five GB athletes who have won gold at what I call the Golden Sweep, the Golden Slam, Olympic, European, Commonwealth, and World Games. Of course, we've mentioned Daley Thompson, we've mentioned Sally Gunnell, Linford Christie, Jonathan Edwards. The fifth is Greg Rutherford, and he's the one always people forget. And, you know, again, he's one of those guys that just, we talk about England not loving the big moments, blowing it under pressure. He's quite the opposite. He often will have a very kind of, you know, injury-rattled season or perform reasonably mediocre level. But then at those big moments, those big big games, those four I've referenced, gold medal, one of only five all time. So I think he is literally one of the most underrated sports stars of all time. I genuinely would love to have that conversation with him personally. I'm working on it, but can't make any promises. But for me, that was one of the key moments for it. Because again, like I say, nobody expected it. I would also like to say what an event it was for, you referenced, I think, wonderfully, you know, the importance of Paralympics. We always talk about and champion the importance of equality in sports for from various different strands and angles. And again, on Super Sunday, who can forget Jessica Ennis? It was just Jessica Ennis at the time, Jessica Ennis Hill, now as she is. And again, that face, that beaming smile was one of those poster moments. And, you know, gold on good, because once again, we're talking weight of the world on her shoulders there. Awesome. But what an event it was to unleash global stars. We talk about the world of boxing, and obviously three world titles now. AJ Joshua, Watford's own, emotional home win for him in London. Nicola Adams, another great boxing star, another great smile, another great female athlete, again claiming gold. Just so many amazing memories for me. Again, always so much respect. Not that I'm a great aficionado of it, but the cycling squad and what they consistently add to Britain's medal halls since that became a focus and a target. I know it's been mired in controversy, but let's not diminish their efforts. But just for me, what was phenomenal about the Games was that sense of unity, that sense of camaraderie, and again, illustrates one of the beautiful elements of sport in what is often a very divisive world, is it has this capacity to summon up that human spirit. Indeed, the very essence of the Olympic spirit was writ large all over London 2012. And great, great shout. One of the phenomenal Games in terms of organization, implementation, and then pressure to perform. Because for all of that, again, it is about bringing home the bacon. England overachieved relative to their medal target, as they've continued to do. But the fact that there was so many great memories, so many medals, and as you say, finishing third in the overall medal table, tremendous to then deliver under the pressure, with the eyes of the world and, of course, the focus of a nation on them. Wonderful, simply wonderful. Jason, I love that. And I want your memories, not just of Super Sunday, but of all that great Olympic time here in the UK. If you were there, if you're one of the thousands of volunteers, truly want to hear your tales, tweet us at Verum Sports. Get involved. Also, want to give a big shout out. It was great recently to hear the social media interaction from one of our Twitterers who was once upon a time the coach of Max Whitlock, of course, who has Hertfordshire connections, a Hertfordshire hero. And again, he performed heroics across gymnastics. So many heroes, Jason, so many great memories. And I know you were there. Just your own personal anecdotes from London 2012.
Yeah, I was very lucky to be able to go to the boxing events. I went to some athletic events and I went to the hockey as well. And it was just a wonderful experience kind of going into the Olympic Park at any kind of event. I went to see, is it Danny Agogo? You know, he was the boxer. Unfortunately, he didn't reach the stratospheric levels of Anthony Joshua. But I think the highlight for me was actually seeing the final and the medal ceremony of the weightlifting. And it's something that stood out for me for many years, because the Chinese athlete was leagues above anybody else. Nobody was even competing. He was getting world records, personal bests that were leagues ahead of everybody else. And he was his own stratosphere. But there was a Thai, I think, competitor, and it was between him and somebody else who was going to get silver, bronze, or fourth. And it was between these few. And throughout the whole of, like, the afternoon, they'd been vying. And then for some reason, the crowd just turned towards the Thai competitor. They really wanted him to do well. And everybody was singing his name, getting behind him on that all-important final lift. And he was struggling away, and everybody's going, go on, go on. And he did it, and he was clapping the crowd, like thanking everybody. And that was one of those moments, you know, London 2012. you know, whether you were from China, Thailand, whatever, you became a Londoner for that afternoon. It was fantastic. And what I would also say, you know, from my memories as well, since then, they've done an amazing job of this longevity. Now, this is something that you mentioned with my World Cup 94 to 2018 kind of chat. Quite often at the Olympics, these parks, these amazing kind of sporting venues are abandoned or left to ruin, and there's no kind of long-term plan. But you have to hand it again to the London organisers. A lot of people saying, what's going to happen to these stadiums? Well, I've been to the Diamond Athletics event that happens every year at the London Stadium. It is absolutely fantastic. West Ham are there as well. The swimming pool is used by the public, but also has great events there. I think all the stadiums have been recycled, reused, and the actual area of the Olympic Park, it has served East London so, so well. It's rejuvenated an area that had been kind of long overlooked by the rest of London. Now it's an up-and-coming yuppie centre. A lot of young people are desiring to move there because it's got great transport connections, but also a really lovely kind of green area. And it's something that London can really be proud of kind of showing for the next generations of Olympic hosts. You can kind of invest in an area and actually make a profit out of it. You know, London, you know, might have overspent a little bit, but I think overall the growth from that project is fourfold. It's ridiculous. So I've got a lot of positive memories at the time. And in subsequent events, you know, I've been to boxing at the Copper Box Arena only a few years ago. It is so fun to go to the Olympic area because not only are they amazing kind of arena, but you then get the amazing nostalgia of 2012 when you go there as well. You kind of see the moments there. I don't know if you've experienced it as well, Tony. So do you have standout moments and have you been to the Olympic Park since that 2012 event?
Only a few times, really. I've been to the Copper Box for a netball event, actually. And, you know, again, that was just stunning. But just appreciate the point. Often there's a lot of PR spin putting to quote-unquote legacy. But that was something that, and give massive credit here to Lord Sebco and team, because they had the vision, they sold the vision, but then they delivered on their promises. And if only more people could then take that and apply it, then I think our general world would be a much happier, more fulfilled place. Truly a great legacy, truly some great longstanding infrastructure in place. And the arenas, as you say, are repurposed and revitalized and continue to be embraced. Truly amazing. What is amazing to me is that it's 8 years ago. It's one of those, isn't it? It kind of locks in the memory banks. Those memories are crystallized and it just feels but a heartbeat away. But 8 years, it's almost a decade now. And, you know, in fact, 2020, it's 12 years away. Goodness me, it goes even further. It's just time flies is my point. But I'm sure many people have got great memories from 12 years ago back here in London, 2012. Do get involved. Tweet us at Verum Sport. Want to hear your views, memories from the London 2012 Games. And of course, generally, 75 years of memories, because this week, Verum Sport Podcasting has hit 75 episodes. So we thought we'd rush back through the sands of time and delve into loads of great memories. Of course, we could devote a lifetime to doing just that. We've only got a bit of finite time to play with, but I know you've got your views. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. Before I fire in with my final selection, another World Cup win from England, but from another sporting angle, a few others that spring to mind. We're talking Olympics. Got to give a shout out to Michael Phelps back in 2008, eight Olympic golds at one meet. He is the all-time winningest Olympian. Great effort there. I just also want to give some sporting infamy. Springs to mind Mike Tyson's ear bite over Evander Holyfield. And of course, no VAR, no goal line technology at the time. We saw it 66, but 86. Hand of God, Maradona. it is a memory. I know it's not necessarily a good one, but you just have to almost appreciate the cheek and the audacity of the man. And let us not forget, he also, in that game against England, scored one of the all-time great goals, certainly one of the all-time great solo efforts there. Cricket, so many memories, of course, a recent World Cup win on our own turf, Lords. Again, Stokes was truly astonishing. It went to Super Six, the final over, and even then, England and New Zealand couldn't be separated. Went back to kind of count back. England won on home turf, literally just over a year ago. What a great memory. What a one springing instantly to mind. But we spoke recently about all-time great batsmen. That was a fascinating inter-era debate. But for me, one of the great entertainers in cricket, not a batsman, but the great bowler that is Shane Warne. And his famous bowl against Mike Gatting absolutely bamboozled him. Truly one of the most stunning bowls, one of the most phenomenal illustrations of the tricky art of wrist spin you'll ever care to see, dubbed the ball of the century. Check it out on YouTube if you haven't seen it. And just the jet blonde Shane Warne announcing himself onto the cricket international arena by truly befuddling a very good player of spin in Mike Gatting is absolutely phenomenal. Again, it was referenced there, the amazing Usain Bolt. Want to give him so much respect, although I still maintain that man didn't quite fulfill his lethal potential. I think he could have smashed a few more records. I really, really do. But that's just me, and I'm maybe being harsh there. But that's just tip of the iceberg stuff. Seriously, it is. Want to hear your views? Do tweet us at Verulam Sport. Your favourite memories, sporting-wise, from the last 75 years. But I'm now drilling us back in time to the 22nd of November, 2003. It was Down Under. Stadium Australia, England beat the old rivals Australia in front of their home fans in the Rugby World Cup, 22nd of November 2003. Goodness me, it was the fifth Rugby World Cup, and it remains the first and only win for England and indeed any Northern Hemisphere nation in the Rugby World Cup history. Just like 1966, as we've already analysed, it required a dramatic extra time result, really, to separate the two nations here, and saw England hold aloft the William Webb Ellis Cup. It was the second Rugby World Cup to be decided in extra time, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I am conscious of it, but I want to give just a mention to this moment, the 95 Rugby World Cup, because sometimes one of the great things about sporting theatre is that it goes hand in hand with global, political, sociological moments, and they fuse in one glorious feast of human achievement and accomplishment. We talk pressure. That was the 1995 home Rugby World Cup for South Africa, the Rainbow Nation, in front of the world great hero Nelson Mandela, and South Africa in front of their home fans prevailed, beating New Zealand 15-12. It took extra time to separate them, and a great effort under pressure. Joel Stransky struck the winning points, and I could talk about that forever and a day. It's one of the most critical moments, not just in sporting history, but sport and sociological, political history over the last three quarters of a century. But just an aside, because it was the only other Rugby World Cup that went to extra time. We spoke TV audiences in the 1966 World Cup. And whilst this is impressive, Jason, again, I want to remind everybody that back in 66, and I know it was a different world pre-internet, obviously only a finite number of channels, et cetera, but once again, that 66 Football World Cup victory was witnessed by 32.3 million TV viewers here in England, remaining the most witnessed, the most watched UK TV event. Now, earlier in another podcast, we spoke about could rugby ever achieve parity with football? And I kind of said, well, yeah, maybe in some kind of abstract infinite universe syndrome, but let's get real. No. Okay. And this kind of illustrates the point. I mean, it's still impressive. It really is. 15 million people in the UK watched England prevail in that Rugby World Cup final back in the 22nd of November, 2003. Again, granted the different worlds, the different TV landscapes, but it does pale into insignificance, less than half compared to that. And indeed, globally, again, just putting the rugby into its proper context, 22 million people across the world witnessed the final, compared to the 30 plus million in England alone who watched the 66 victory. So again, whilst it is the third most watched sporting event across the world, with the rugby world, with the Olympics being one, the Football World Cup being two, Rugby World Cup then comes in at three, it does pale into insignificance, really, compared to football. So just to give rugby its kind of cultural, sociological context there. There were, though, my goodness me, some over 80,000 people packing out Stadium Australia. It was 82,958 in attendance. Tricky path to the final. Australia opened the tournament with a 24-8 victory over Argentina. They then smashed Namibia 142-0. That's not the all-time record score in the tournament, which goes to New Zealand. I think back in 95 with 145, but that 142-0 scoreline is the tournament's biggest ever points differential. Again, maybe sadly demonstrating how rugby still has a ways to go to cultivate its true global status there, with Namibia absolutely destroyed. They then beat Romania and narrowly edged out Ireland 17-16, which meant Australia topped Pool A. Play 4, 1-4, points for 273, points against a mere 32 points. England were in Group C. They also topped this, but less emphatically. There was actually question marks over Johnny Wilkinson. Goodness me, it's hard to believe that now. But people were questioning him. He looked under pressure in the early group phases. And indeed, even against Wales in the quarterfinal, people were question marks against the great Johnny Wilkinson. They have now been long forgotten. Such is human memory. England in Group C smashed Georgia 84-6. Goodness me, Georgia have improved. Exciting to see them join the Northern Hemisphere tournaments coming up in the next few months. England then beat South Africa by 25 points to 6, edged out and looked edgy against Samoa, and then overcame Uruguay by 111 points to 13, meaning they topped Pool C. The quarterfinals saw Australia cruise past Scotland by 33 points to 16. And England, as I mentioned, played Wales, obviously these two great old rivals, and they won it 28-17. But again, looked a team under pressure, a team at that moment where we talk about the media hype and then the media tendency to build up the downslide, when one or two knives were certainly circling. One or two journalists, if they have to be honest, would admit to that. And it was amazing. Therefore, I would suggest that England had such an indelible, built-in iron strength of character and identity that they were able to overcome that and ultimately prevail. Anyway, semi-final time now. Australia overcame their old rivals, New Zealand, by 22 points to 10, cruising to a home final. England then went through the gears, beginning to turn on the style, beat France by 24 points to 7, setting up that final against Australia. In the final itself, Australia claimed first blood, Lottie Takiri outjumping Jason Robinson for a try after 6 minutes. Now, we talk about moments that sometimes get forgotten, but they prove crucial. This try was not converted, meaning that whilst they went 5-0 up, it could have been 7. And those 2 points literally could have seen Australia claiming championships. These are the narrowest of angles, these narrow inches, which at these massive occasions matter. In the final analysis, it gets forgotten. But goodness me, England were delighted that Elton Flatley's conversion effort of the Lottie Tokiri try early in the game struck the post, meaning while they claimed the points 5-0, it was not all seven. England, though, as I mentioned, had tremendous spirit by this stage, and they refused to lay down. They fought back through a Johnny Wilkinson penalty after 11 minutes, making the scoreline 5 to Australia, 3 to England. England then nudged ahead on 20 minutes, another Wilkinson penalty, 6 to 5, England lead. He claimed his third penalty of the half after 28 to take the scoreline to 9 to 5. Then the effervescent, one of the all-time England greats across rugby union and rugby league, Jason Billy Whiz Robinson, whizzed over for a try on 38 minutes. Wilkinson himself couldn't convert, but it meant that England went in at the half leading by 14 points to 5. Tell you what though, my goodness me, it was a fascinating second half. England dominated time of the ball and possession, but ultimately this is one of the reasons why I love your stats. They never tell the whole picture. It's about what you do with the quality of your time and indeed your possession. And whilst England huffed and puffed, they could not get on the scoreboard, and Australia were never going to lie down and die in front of their fervent home faithful. England pack were penalised, and Australia pushed back into contention with a penalty from Flatley on 48 minutes. As I mentioned, England totally dominated in terms of time of possession and territory, but they could not pull ahead. Johnny Wilkinson missing 2 drop goal attempts. Thankfully, as it turned out, these were but dress rehearsals for his moment of glory a bit later on. But as I say, England failed to add to their score in this half, and 2 further Flatley penalties, one on 61 minutes, then one right at the death on 80 minutes, meant the scorelines were deadlocked, 14 all. Much like, although from a different sport, that epic extra time was required for 66 win, England also had to dig deep here in 2003. Wilkinson and Flatley shared penalties. And then with just 26 seconds remaining on the clock, Wilkinson swung his famous right foot, and England were riding the sweet chariot of victory, 20 points to 17. Again, it remains the only Northern Hemisphere victory to date in the Rugby World Cup history, going back to 1987, and England's only victory in this tournament to boot. One of my favourite memories. We're talking sporting moments there. Come up the hour, come up the man. The under pressure, under fire, Johnny Wilkinson showed why those claims were churlish. What a moment. What a moment of glory. And World Cup win again for England. One of my all-time favourite sporting memories. Certainly all-time, definitely for the last 3/4 of a century. Jason, just wondering your thoughts and recall, if you can, of 2003 for England.
Well, what I love, kind of bringing it to the 75 podcasts that we have done, my memories of the time, of celebration, the ecstasy of it, and it, the fact that it was in November was also like another birthday gift for me, it was fantastic. But what I loved is it was a true team effort, and in one of our podcasts, the underrated heroes of sporting history, you mentioned one, Richard Hill. And kind of talking about his individual brilliance, not just in this final, I know he was taken up on the 93rd minute, but his ability in that World Cup to do things that others weren't. I think he was injured, wasn't he? And then he was brought in. That was how important he was. And you've mentioned, on other Lions tours, other England kind of moments. Wilkinson, Robinson, Matt Dawson, Delalio, all these kind of individuals, they kind of had the limelight, but if it wasn't for individuals like Hill, there would have been no World Cup victory. He did, the unfashionable jobs. And this is what I love about kind of team sport. We talk about the Maradonas, Pelés, we talk about the Wilkinsons, all these kind of, Dan Carter is always talked about in reverent tones, and my God, his record is fantastic. Will it ever be beaten? But they all have players around them. And this is what I love about team sport, is that you rely on others. It breaks down barriers. And what England achieved at that World Cup was so fantastic because of the belief in each other, the trust. And you talk about how through the tournament they had so many moments, and arguably Australia went into that final with the psychology on their side. You know, they'd cruised to quite a lot of victories, whereas England had fought, a lot of things had gone against them. They hadn't had an easy ride there, but they had to trust each other. And I think that that was one of the big things that saw them through. And I think rugby kind of emphasises that a lot with, you know, many other sports. If your forwards or your backs aren't working in tandem with each other, then you're just not going to get the victory. And I think this was a beautiful, beautiful display. Yes, it was a tight game, but would you have it any other way, Tony? I mean, having that sensational moment, I mean, it's getting the hairs back up on my neck kind of thinking of that moment where you just saw it go across and over the posts. Wilkinson seals that final.
The ecstasy, the jubilation writ on his face is tremendous. And just on a personal anecdote, it was my father's 60th birthday last year. And for his birthday, I got him a signed copy of that Johnny Wilkinson moment. And it's pride of place in the house.
Goodness me.
And it's nice just to walk up to it every now and again and just see him turning, not to camera, just to teammates, with sheer jubilation writ all over his face. As you say, team effort, no questions about it. But so much respect for Johnny Wilkinson. His 227 points remains all-time top scorer in Rugby World Cup history. But he was under pressure, Jason. Seriously, people forget this now. But the British media had the knives out for him. He was looking nervy in the group games, and Wales targeted him, and it wasn't his most glorious performance against Wales. But honestly, that World Cup final, come of the hour, come of the man again, Wilkinson stepped up to the plate. Two things, though, very super quickly. One, a lovely bit of connectivity to 1966 and all that. Is there a more successful sporting household than the Coens? Ben Coen was on the wing for England that day in 03. His uncle George is a World Cup winner from 1966, played in the England World Cup winning team. So a lovely little bit of sporting connection. And George indeed flew out to Australia to witness his nephew Ben claim the World Cup in rugby there. Now, you made a really wonderful point about the unique, almost quad team sport. Rugby union, for me, is really preeminent amongst that across all team sports. And I want to give so much credit to Wilkinson and to Clive Woodward for all that he did. And I'm just going to briefly come back to that in just a second. But I want to first and foremost heap massive praise on Martin Johnson. The guy's eked out of granite. You mentioned, obviously, as I did myself previously, the silent assassin, Richard Hill, and his efforts. Johnson more in the limelight in the sense that he was the captain, but they were cut from the same cloth. I was very lucky many years ago now on a galaxy far, far away to be at Martin Johnson's retirement press conference at Welford Road when he retired from Leicester Tigers. And being the kind of audacious, cheeky wannabe reporter that I was, and to a degree still remain, after it was, oh, the pros did their business, I thought, I'm never going to be here again. So I raised my little paw. The press reporter nodded vaguely in my direction, and I seized that moment. And I posed the great man the question. I mean, it's not the most original question, but I just asked him, Martin, you cheated again. World Cup wins, British Lions wins, European and League Championships domestically. But how would you like to be remembered? He took a moment and fixed his wonderful scowl at me. And he said, as a man who put his body on the line for the team, as a bloody good teammate. What an epitaph. And from his mouth itself, that sets the tone. You know, we talk about talk is cheap. He is a man who led by physical action and endeavour. Not necessarily a natural leader, but a mega giant in every sense of the word, all 6'7", 18 stones of him. And he was a giant. And you would follow him into the trenches. Because quite frankly, you'd be rather scared of the consequences of not doing so. But yeah, Martin Johnson, what an icon. But massive credit and I could again eulogize about this till the cows come home. I'm going to try to keep it brief, to the brainchild, the architect that is Clive Woodward, Sir Clive now, rightly so. Look, it wasn't all smooth sailing to this World Cup victory. There was lots of problems and issues and teething problems along the way, but it was a vision. And when he took over, I think in 97, there wasn't even so much as an office for an England head coach. So we think nowadays of all the sporting data, all the you know, the analysis and sports science and physiology. I'm not saying that Clive was alone in bringing this to English rugby, but he was instrumental in traveling the world, taking on lessons from American football, from football itself, all different things he could learn from. And some of these ideas he'd try and they wouldn't quite fit, but he, over time, and credit to the RFU for sticking with him, because there were times when it was almost looking a little bit mad scientist-esque. But again, credit to the RFU for showing commitment. But what a visionary. That word is thrown away around again like confetti. But Jason, honestly, it's not hyperbole. It's historical fact. When he took over in 97, remember, rugby union itself as a game only went professional in 95. And in 97, the head coach of the second biggest sport in the country didn't even so much have an office. He was, from that moment to World Cup glory just 6 years later, the architect, the visionary, the master. And I'm going to give you, again, it takes the players on the pitch to then deliver it. We know that. But all of that was made possible for him making all those changes, embracing all this new technology and making and paving the way as rugby union continues to advance forwards as all sports do. But as I say, what a great moment. 2003 in Australia, making it all the sweeter, beating the old enemy. It was tense. It was drama, sporting theatre of the highest degree. Would I have had it any other way? Quite frankly, I'd love to have smashed them. But my goodness me, something to be said for an extra time, 20-17 victory away in Stadium Australia.
Yeah, you totally summed it up there, Tony. And I think the interesting story with Sir Clive as well is he's somebody like Wilkinson. You know, the 1999 World Cup kind of campaign, people were asking for his head, you know, and then 2000, 2001, the Six Nation victory appeased individuals. But he was frighteningly close to the door as well. I mean, it's kind of like the Ferguson FA Cup game. Yep. If he hadn't won that, you know, 2000 Six Nations trophy, could there have been a different era with England? You know, he was unarguably the architect of it. But this is how fickle and frugal football fans are. Not football, but sports fans in general. You know, they forget how much is done behind the scenes. They forget the importance of these individuals. They don't know the whole story, the whole amazing work that Sir Clive had to go through. And so, frankly, you know, I don't think it can be emphasised enough, the amazing journey that England went from, you know, the 90s, from an amateur sport into truly professional and on a world stage. I think it is a wonderful moment in terms of, you know, not just British sport, but all sport in general. And I think you're totally right to bring it up for the 75 special.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one that really sticks in my memory banks. I'll never forget it. I'm sure you can't as well, but I'm sure you've got loads of other memories. Do tweet us at Verulam Sports. Love to hear from you. Your favourite memories, your favourite moments, your favourite where we use, which sports captures. Want to hear from you. It's such a vast topic. 75 years covering all of those events. So many, unfortunately, we couldn't even touch upon. But I know you want to get involved. Do keep involved. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. And next week, we revert back to type and we will have a sporting debate based on you, the wonderful listeners, choosing. So looking forward to that. But it felt appropriate in the week that saw us clock up 75 podcast episodes to take a little bit of a whistle stop tour through 75 years of sporting memories, moments. And I always like to conclude, I think for me, sport is theatre, human theatre. And is so powerful accordingly. Jason, just finally, any final thoughts for you on tonight's chat or anything else that springs to mind quickly through 75 years of sporting epic moments?
I think, you know, we've covered it in previous episodes, all these amazing moments throughout history. And like you said from the very beginning, we could talk about this till the cows come home. I'm just hoping, you know, maybe casting an eye to the future, that the next 75 years of sport maybe eradicates some of the problems that we still see of racism, sexism, and all those sort of problems. But also what I would love to see is maybe a convergence in the upper leagues. You know, the fact that teams like Manchester City and Liverpool can dominate leagues, I would love it if we saw the likes of maybe Burnley or somebody else having a Premier League title to their name, a la Leicester. That would be fantastic. You know, even as an Arsenal fan, I can put my hands up and say that still brings a tear to my eye of the beautiful story of the ascendancy of sport. And I think that's what sport needs. We need more stories like that. We need more kind of connection with the fans, and sport cannot forget its roots. So here's to possibly toasting to 75 years of positivity, growth, and amazing new memories in sport. And I think, you know, 2021, we will see the Tokyo Olympics finally. And I think from there, Tony, it can only be upwards.
Yeah, I love that. And surely in the next 75 years, there's got to be a World Cup win in football again for us. But as I say, for me, I don't want to end on a negative piece because, Jason, I love that element of positivity. Always, I'm a pint half full gentleman, but I still maintain it is an abject farce that England haven't claimed another victory in any international event in football post 66. Do please give me your opinions as to why. Love to hear from you. Tweet at Verulam Sport. But sport is life. Sport is drama. Sport is phenomenal. And we're going to be pouring more on this on regular sporting debates each and every single week. Again, it's your choosing. So make sure you keep involved with Verulam Sport and continue to tweet us. Keep the machine busy at Verulam Sport. But for now, thoroughly enjoyed this. Great to spring back some phenomenal memories and recall World Cup wins, etc., etc. Thank you again, Machine Jason McKenna. You are a man, but a genuine bona fide legend. I appreciate your time always and your insights. But also, thank you for listening. Keep well, keep safe, and all the best.